it's time to go to London and to talk to our old friend Ian. Let me remind you that Ian's editor of politics.co.uk, and I want him to give us a report card on Boris Johnson's first brief stint as a Prime Minister. What's your assessment, please, Ian?
I'm going to go with D minus. It's an extraordinary couple of weeks, really. He's barely present. You don't actually see him very much. But the messages that are put out by him and by Dominic Cummings, who's basically in charge of things behind the scene, are increasingly frenzied and increasingly radical. This sort of new form of kind of Tory Trotskyism, which sort of envisages just tearing down every institution, the very things which Conservatives always told us they supported, things like Parliament, things like the judiciary, even the monarchy. All of these things seem to be sort of collateral damage, really, in this ferocious attempt to secure a no-deal Brexit on the 31st of October. So while there's no real concrete achievements as yet, all we've got is the rhetoric, and the rhetoric is becoming increasingly ferocious, increasingly deranged.
I understand that he may face a no-confidence motion, and he said he won't stand down if he loses it, but that could lead to the sort of constitutional crisis in which the Queen has to get involved. Now, you know, we have the Queen, you know, keeping an eye on our problems, and she does intervene from time to time, as she did with the Whitlam dismissal. It would be enormously embarrassing, would it not, if he did, in fact, renege on tradition?
Yeah, it would. It's extraordinary to see the kind of suggestions that are being made. And this gives you an indication of the severity of where things are. So, I mean, we have something called the Fixed Terms Parliament Act, and this basically tried to put some sort of control on the way that elections worked in Britain. Before then, the Prime Minister could basically just call an election whenever they liked. And so they passed this act. It seemed like a pretty good idea at the time, but, you know, politics is made up of unintended consequences. And what the act said was, look, if there's a no-confidence vote, Prime Minister, then there's 2 weeks at which either the Prime Minister or other parties see if they can try and form a government. See if they can try to come up with an individual in the Commons who can get a majority of MPs saying, well, look, I support them for now. Boris Johnson has said that if there's a no-confidence vote on him, which we're expecting in September and which probably he will lose, he would then just stay on as Prime Minister. What that means is that then you'd have MPs among the other opposition parties and some Tory rebels. We think there's enough Tory rebels. Come up with someone else. I mean, it might be Jeremy Corbyn, but that's a pretty hard person to get behind. So let's say they went for someone that they found more respectable, like Keir Starmer or something. They would then get behind this person, show that they could have a majority. And by Boris Johnson still staying in Downing Street, he would effectively be saying to the Queen, well, look, you make the call now. You decide whether it's going to be me just sat here without, you know, with no confidence, or whether it's going to be this other individual. That is an extraordinary state of affairs, because what that's asking is basically for the Queen to come in and operate, I mean, a massive degree of political controversy at a very heightened moment, and to come in and make the call. Now, that is not the way it has to operate. He could happily say, well, look, as soon as there's no confidence, I'll stand back. But he's not doing that. So he's threatening really to drag the monarchy right into the heart of this kind of gurning, horrific political situation that we're in.
We had Anthony Grayling, AC Grayling, on the program last night. He spoke very warmly about you, incidentally, off air.
Oh,
his theory is that Boris is just the front man, that the real power is behind the scenes. It's a tantalising thought. Could it be true?
I don't know. Well, I mean, I feel bad contradicting him now if he's been nice about me. But I'm never too keen on that sort of assessment. I sort of prefer that just the most basic analysis that you can come to, which is just that things are as they are presented to be. And in this circumstance, there is a political culture within the Conservative Party and potentially within enough of the electorate to win an election, in which it makes sense to go for no deal Brexit, to go for broke for it and deal with the consequences later, because ultimately the public is split in two between Remain and Leave, and the Leavers have overwhelmingly drifted towards no deal, and that those are the calculations ultimately that Boris Johnson is making. Now, there are plenty of powerful people, there's some rich people as well who want Brexit, there are plenty of allies of Boris Johnson who have a lot of money who are already trying to short basically sterling and just basically taking a gamble on the fact that Britain is about to go into significant decline. But that, I don't think, is at the heart of why this is happening. I think this is ultimately happening for quite grubby short-term electoral instincts. And if Boris Johnson thought that his personal political position would be hugely improved by running as a prime minister that was on stability, that was on liberalism, that was on an open society, then he would do that. But he doesn't, because he doesn't think that that's ultimately where his fortunes lie. They lie in this kind of crazed, almost sort of millennial idea of no-deal Brexit, and that is what he's ended up pursuing.
Can I ask you about the Scottish National Party? Is there a chance that they'll call for a second referendum?
They'll certainly... Oh, you mean a second referendum on Scottish independence?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly going to go for it. I mean, they made that clear almost immediately, actually. I think it was hours after the Leave vote in 2016. Nicola Sturgeon, the leader of the party, came out and went, well, look, we said we wouldn't call for another referendum while the material circumstances were the same. It is now clearly the case that the material circumstances have changed and we therefore want another referendum. They have a very strange problem. On the plus side, everything that is happening politically increases the argument for Scottish independence. Their argument throughout has been, look, England doesn't care about you. We are just connected to this thing. They will implement policies with being completely indifferent as to what it is that Scotland wants. And Scotland voted for Remain, and it's being forced out in the most crazed form of Brexit imaginable. So they honestly couldn't have asked for a better demonstration of all the arguments they have made. However, there's a bit of an issue for them. And the issue is the single market. That at the moment, all of Britain, including Scotland, and all of Europe are in the same market. So you can put goods wherever you like without checks because you all have exactly the same regulatory standards. You don't need to make sure, you know, for instance, that the chemicals in a product are the same and have the same laws. If Britain was to leave the single market and then Scotland left Britain, it would find itself caught between two different regulatory markets. So it would have to decide, do we want our goods to flow freely to Europe, or do we want our goods to flow freely around Britain? And that is a very difficult decision to make. They lost the last referendum on the basis of people's economic concerns about independence. So now they've got this extraordinary position where politically they're in the strongest position they've ever been. But economically, the argument is harder than ever to make.
I understand that there's a worst case scenario, which is concerns food security and also the availability of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, Britain doesn't make its own food. It for years now has been under 50% of the food it eats, the stuff it makes. And British consumers have become incredibly complacent about this. You know, they eat fruits from all around the world at any time of year without really giving much thought to the kind of logistical structures underneath them that allow that to take place. And it takes place because of basically just-in-time transportation systems to make sure that that is there in the supermarket. Under no deal, the expectation is that you're going to get blockages on the border, you're going to get them hard. Most of the reason is because people aren't used to filling out the export processing requirements that are required to trade with Europe and vice versa. Now, in that situation, the food industry has come out today. Obviously, they're instantly written off as these sort of mad Project Fear Remainers trying to increase fear. I mean, these guys are not interested in being engaged in politics. They're just trying to come up with basics about how things will operate under no deal. And their response today is to say, look, if you do no deal, our expectation of the government is this. You have to treat food industry as if we are now a command economy operating basically at wartime. We cannot have the competition rules that we have. We are going to have shortages of different products in different parts of the country. And we are going to have to operate basically like some sort of, you know, proto-socialist republic, taking in a certain amount, distributing it over there. Of course, again, it's all knocked down. But again, this is basically the conclusion of really quite sensible people talking about their own industry. But things here are so tribal that really it's the kind of thing that only Remainers listen to and Leavers just say it's all lies.
You know, Brexit used to be the most boring of topics and it's now electrifying. It's as though the topic itself was nuclear powered. Ian, thanks for that. That's Ian Dunn, of course, editor of politics.co.uk.